You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered and solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. Mm-hmm. And if you're listening on Friday and you want to tell your friends that we rebroadcast on Monday.
Absolutely. And also check out writersvoices.com and KRUUFM.com for past shows.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's they do that, don't they?
Yes, yeah.
Because the word spreads, because we have some very interesting authors, and this is definitely one of them. And the book today is The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom, and by Helen Thorpe. Helen is a writer who lives in Denver, Colorado. She has been a staff writer for the New York Observer, The New Yorker, and Texas Monthly. She has also written freelance stories for the New York Times, Magazine, Slate, and other publications. Her radio stories have aired on This American Life and Soundpoint. Print. The Newcomers is her third book, and it is a very interesting book, and it took a lot of research, took a lot of time.
Welcome back to Writers' Voices, Helen.
So glad to be with you again.
Yes, we interviewed Helen about Soldier Girls.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, which was about female soldiers, obviously.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it does seem like you're drawn to subjects that are very, very of the moment, Helen.
I like finding a topical issue that everybody's talking about, where there's not yet deep enough understanding, and trying to write something so that people can understand.
Right, and showing a different perspective, a more in-depth detail, because, face it, a lot of our media, our news media, is very much on the surface.
For sure,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
And it's hard because we're trying to have important conversations, but we're not quite having them the right way if we don't have all the information we need. And I definitely feel like we could do better on the subject of refugees, for sure.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Was there something in particular that drew you to this subject and this angle on approaching the subject?
Well, of course, when it comes to something like immigration or refugees, I'm always influenced by the fact that my parents immigrated to the U.S. with me when I was a baby. Mm-hmm. And my parents are Irish. I was born in London when they were living there, and then they immigrated from London to the U.S. And growing up with a green card and things like that, I identify with immigrants. Of course, this is the only country I remember, but nonetheless, I identify with families trying to relocate here to have a better life. And then the refugee story was just taking over the front pages of newspapers as I was wondering what to write about next, and I thought, well, I wonder how that international story intersects with my own city, my own community, my own backyard. And that's how I wound up at South High School.
We don't think of Denver as being a place where there's a lot of immigration.
No, we don't.
But
sure, I know. You know, one of the subjects in the book even says when she heard she was going to be in Denver, she thought, oh my gosh, there's just going to be a lot of cowboys. Originally from Burma. And
yeah, well, I'm sure.
But we do have a lot of refugees. Like a lot of, medium-sized cities kind of around the Midwest or the West, we do have a lot of refugees. And it's because our churches have been active in refugee resettlement for a long time.
Well, that's a good way to bring refugees into a community, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great way. And the church volunteers who do this work are their most passionate advocates, really. And I was really interested working on this project, just meeting some of the church volunteers, because right this second, if you just pay attention to the media, it seems like only liberal people on that end of the spectrum are the ones who are meant to be supporting refugees. But what I found just out and about with refugee families was I kept intersecting with more conservative-minded church volunteers, evangelical Christians who were working with these families. So the media debate does not really represent the reality very well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I was interested in the fact that there were so many different these students were from so many different countries. I mean, all over the place.
Right.
And of course, they not only had to learn English, but they had to communicate with one another, and that posed some problems too.
Yeah, I did not understand myself, at the outset, all the different countries that were going to be represented in this one classroom that I was visiting. So I spent the year inside a very beginner-level English language acquisition room, and I watched which students arrived that year and how did one teacher teach all of them English. So by the end of the year, he collected his students as the year went along, just as they arrived in the U.S. By the end of the year, he had 22 kids, and they spoke 14 different languages. They used eight different alphabets.
Yeah.
Just wild that one teacher was teaching all of them English. And, yeah, they were from countries that I didn't know were, some of the biggest senders of refugees to the United States. And, again, the reality is a little different than the media conversation. So in this room, there were four kids from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that's how I learned that's the number one sender of refugees to the U.S. in recent years.
Ah.
Burma's been another big country sending refugees, and there were two kids from there, and two kids from Iraq, another big producer of refugees.
Wow.
Kids from Eritrea, another country in Africa, sending a lot of refugees here. So the room kind of mapped the whole crisis very accurately.
Now, are these kids in this class all day learning English, or do they have other classes where they're, even though they don't know English, they have to sit in another class?
Great question. So because these kids test as possessing a really minimal amount of English, they're in this English language acquisition class three periods a day, almost half their day, every day. But then they do take math and they take science. But those classes they take with teachers who are trained to teach students who are newly arrived in the U.S. and have minimal English. So the teachers use a lot of visual cues. Like I remember one day in the math class, which I visited, I watched the math teacher teach the kids about slope, and he showed them a video of a roller coaster like going down a steep descent and up a steep ascent, and then he was having them stand and hold their arms out and pantomime, this is positive slope, this is negative slope. Like, if you can imagine teaching math that way.
Wow.
No, it's kind of wild.
Well, math is kind of a universal language.
I was just going to say, isn't math math everywhere?
Yeah, but to explain it without using English, and fairly complex English, is really hard.
The teacher was explaining it in English, but using tons of visual cues to kind of clue the kids into what his English words meant.
Okay, so are numbers just numbers in English, or are numbers numbers everywhere?
So the kids arrived always, this isn't always true, but these particular kids arrived knowing our alphabet in addition to whatever alphabet their home language was in, and knowing the number system as well. So was literate in both numbers and our Latin script.
Well, that helped a lot, didn't it?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And some of the kids were arriving already speaking. There was one girl from Africa who spoke seven languages. English was going to be her eighth language. I thought that was amazing.
Wow. Well, you say that students who are multilingual learn another language much faster than students who only know one language.
Ah.
Right.
But, I never thought about whether the numeral system is the same in all languages or not. I don't.
Yeah.
And we don't think about that, do we?
That
yeah, right. Well, I also found interesting that there were several languages that had the same word for the word book. Very, very similar words.
I was fascinated by that, too.
That was interesting.
Because I speak a little bit of Spanish, I was aware that Spanish and English have about a third of their words in common.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand that some of the other languages represented in this classroom, like Arabic, and that some of the languages spoken in Africa, that they shared a lot of words in common. And as you're pointing out, a lot of languages in the Middle East and a lot of languages in Africa have the same word for book.
Yeah.
Kitab. And it's even similar in Hebrew also.
That is very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Certain words, I think, travel through languages just because of shared history and because those words are very important. So the word for book and the word for heart among the words that had traveled really far through the Middle East and through Africa.
Well, book I can kind of understand because books weren't invented when those languages first developed. They came along later. And so as the concept of the book maybe moved from one area to another, the word might have traveled with it.
Maybe? You know, I think...
Could be.
Mom's looking at me a little skeptically.
No, I'm not. I mean, we have no idea how a language travels, you know, and how language develops and how it developed in the first place.
To me, that's the etymology of words and how they developed is always fascinating to me.
Well, you know,
I had to speak with linguists to try and puzzle through this myself and try and understand it better. And, of course, if you don't speak those foreign languages that you're trying to understand, which is true for me, it's very hard to grasp these things. But some of the linguists that I spoke with really helped me understand. Like, I didn't know, for example, that in Arabic, not only is Arabic written from right to left, the opposite direction than we write in, but also they structure their sentences differently. So we say a subject and then a verb, like, I ran. But in Arabic, you reverse it. It's the verb first. You would say, ran I. It's kind of like how Yoda talks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Helen Thorpe, author of The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. How were you able to communicate with the students initially why you were there?
You know, at the outset, it was really difficult. Communication was pretty minimal because I didn't speak most of the languages they, knew, and they didn't speak enough English. But by about midway through the year, they had acquired some English, and I would go around asking them, would it be okay if I met with you over lunch with an interpreter? And they would say yes, and then I would bring in an interpreter who spoke Arabic or who spoke Swahili or who spoke Tigrinya, the language that's common in Eritrea. And then I would sit down with a student individually and just say, I'm a journalist. You know, you've seen me in your classroom. I'm trying to write a book about refugee resettlement and your classroom and what I can learn about refugees from your room. Would you like to tell me your story? And then I tried, to make clear it's totally your choice. You don't have to do this. But, the vast majority of the kids, 21 of the 22 kids, wanted to be in the book, wanted to tell their story, which was amazing.
And do you know the one who did not, do you know why?
her dad forbid her. He said he didn't want her to be in the press.
Okay.
She actually wanted to talk to me, but her dad said no. Understood.
Oh, yeah, sure, because it was interesting to me, too, that English contains roughly 250,000 words.
Yeah.
But most of us only use about 10,000 of them. And I don't even think I use that many.
Wow.
It's really something, isn't it?
As a writer, my job is to use as many different words as I possibly can, but I think I'm right there with you. I'm not sure I have the greatest vocabulary ever.
Now, how does that compare to the vocabulary of some of these other languages?
You know, I'm not an expert on all the languages in the world, but I do know, for example, that learning a language like Chinese is incredibly difficult because not only does Chinese have a lot of different words, but if you think about it, their alphabet has many, many, many more characters than our alphabet. So, like, my sister, I just know a tiny bit about Chinese because my sister studied Chinese when she was in high school and college, and she would tell me just how hard it was to remember all these different characters.
Well, my grandchildren, their mother was born in Taiwan, and their grandparents speak Chinese, and their other grandparents. And so they have learned some. They're 5 and 8 years old now. And I try and get them to teach me some, but apparently my pronunciation is just so bad they don't even want to bother.
The only thing I know how to say in Chinese is left over from several decades ago when I visited my sister there. I'm in my 50s, and when this happened, I was in my 20s. But I went to visit, and she introduced me to so many people that I heard her saying over and over again, Tasa Wara JJ, which means this is my older sister. Yeah.
I know how to say hello.
Mei Mei, this is my younger sister. They have a different term for Mei Mei, older sister,
yes,
or younger sister. You can't just say sister.
Right,
they,
right.
The older, yeah, so
yes.
Funny.
My granddaughters, they call, she's called Mei Mei.
Yeah,
oh, she's the little
lovely
sister. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So what is Logan called then, big brother?
Oh, there's a word for that too, but I can't remember what it is.
I don't know the brother one because I was just a sister.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, Mei Mei.
Languages are really interesting, really, really fascinating.
They are.
I learned a lot, you know, about the languages just trying to understand these kids. But I was trying to understand their journeys here and I got to spend time with some of the families outside the classroom, which helped a lot.
Mm-hmm.
With this Iraqi family, they invited me over for meals a lot, and one of the things they liked to do was to eat sitting on the living room floor. So because they wanted to celebrate, we wouldn't sit at the table. They would put all the food on the floor, and that's where we would sit down and eat, which I thought was hilarious, but this was traditional for them.
Now, how did you choose this particular classroom in this particular school?
Sure. Well, South High School in Denver is the designated place in our school system where kids are sent if their schooling's been interrupted, and generally that would be, like, because of war would be the reason a kid might not have been at school for a long time. And it's also where they're sent if they speak foreign languages other than Spanish and they need some support. So by default, then they get a lot of the refugee students in our city. There's schools like this, you know, across the country, anywhere there's a refugee resettlement happening. But South has been doing it for quite a long time, and they've gotten very, very good at it. And they're kind of known as being really, really good at helping refugee teenagers integrate into our society, both teaching them English, but also socially helping them play on sports teams and serve in student government. And so I wanted to watch that happening. And then I picked the beginner level class because that's where all the newly arrived refugees were going to be concentrated. And I kind of wanted to see what is it like when you just get to the United States and you've only just arrived, and you don't know any English, and you're trying to figure out America. What is that experience like?
Well, that teacher in this class was amazing, wasn't he?
He was heroic. I love this man. I think he's extraordinary. He's a tall guy, 6'4" tall. He's a former soccer player and soccer coach. He started teaching English as a second language because he really liked coaching kids and watching them evolve, and so he thought he would want to become a teacher. But also, he was inspired by his mom. So the teacher's name is Eddie Williams. His dad's Anglo, but his mom's Latina, and she herself had grown up in a Spanish-speaking household and had been in English language acquisition classes when she was a student. And for her, it had been kind of an upsetting, difficult experience because back in the day, you know, students were made to feel ashamed if they didn't know English, and that was kind of a way to motivate them to learn English, but she found that painful. And so this teacher worked really, really hard to make sure the kids in his classroom would feel they were treated with dignity and respect, even if they didn't know English, and that he could kind of coax them along gently on their journey, and he thought that they would learn English more quickly that way.
Well, I think he was no doubt right, and some of them had horrific things in their background that, you know, if they didn't find kindness in their classroom and kindness here in the United States, it would hold them back because they
right.
would, you know.
They wouldn't open up. That's
no.
right. They would shut down, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did not delve in too much to the specific difficult experiences that one or, you know, another kid had. I did not want to cause the kids, you know, I didn't want to re-traumatize them by asking them in the middle of their school day about what they had witnessed in a war zone or anything
right.
like that.
Right.
But you're absolutely right that some of the kids were carrying very difficult memories, and I tried to be respectful of that. And if I was curious about what their family's journey had been, I asked the kids if I could visit their parents at home, and I let their parents tell me as much or as little as they wanted to
mm-hmm.
about what, you know, what had forced them out of their home country in the first place.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, that was the right way to do it, to engage the parents, because after all, you know, they, in many cultures, the parents are respected, and, you know, people and the students, well, just like the young woman who didn't want to be, you know, her story told because her father said no, so she respected that.
Right. Yeah, it was important to me to try to go about this the right way. I had been handed a lot of access to these students. What happened was when I walked in the school at the beginning, it was August 2015, it was right before the school year started, I met with the principal, and she said, oh, I read your first book, and that book I had written about young people growing up in Denver, Mexican-American families. I was writing about four young women who were Mexican-American, and two of them had legal status, but two did not. And I was writing about the difficulty of the two without legal status, how they, you know, couldn't fit in well to society, didn't have all the same rights and opportunities, and were just struggling with what to do with that. Anyway, this principal at South High School had read my first book and said, you know, I know you'll treat our students well, so you can be in any classroom in the school and take as long as you want. And so to get the chance to spend a year inside this classroom was really unusual. And I felt then I had to really rise to the occasion and handle these kids with care, because they have lived through things that I have never experienced that are just much harder, more difficult than anything I know.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to be, you know, the best journalist I could possibly be, and not just, like, let my curiosity run amok and ask them all sorts of questions in the middle of their school day that would just be upsetting.
And
I had to behave really responsibly.
Of course.
And that, you know, the principal had sort of granted me this unusual time in the room.
I was going to say she had trusted you with this, and the students were trusting you too. I'm sure once they got to know you, they were trusting you to do things.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I think the principal, in addition to what you just said, was also, she had a lot of faith in her students. She knew that they have very powerful stories, and that they are, when you get to know them, and, you know, the experience of getting to know these students is itself transformative. She knew they would have that effect on me.
Mm-hmm.
They'd had that effect on her. You know, when you hear about what these kids have lived through, you're just left kind of in awe of their strength and their resilience, the fact that they can show up in this, you know, totally new country here and actually master English in a relatively short amount of time. They learn it faster than their parents even. Their brains are so, you know, they have these young plastic brains that can absorb a new language so quickly. And it's amazing to see them. I was struck. In particular, there were two boys in this classroom, brothers from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and they arrived just knowing really mostly Swahili, but at the end of their first year, the teacher's saw that they had acquired so much English, he let them jump over a year and a half of instruction. And in their second year of schooling here in America, they went into mainstream classes and started reading To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
Amazing.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it.
Now, we, you know, we're familiar with the refugee crisis in the Sudan and in the Middle East, but were these kids all refugees and not just immigrants? And what are some of the other things that are causing refugees?
Yeah, so in this room, there were 22 kids, and about two-thirds of them arrived with refugee status. And the other kids were immigrants of various kinds, like... So the kids who arrived with refugee status, they had been, you know, vetted by five federal agencies, the Department of Homeland Security. They arrived with all of their documents. They were part of the official refugee pipeline. Some of the other kids in the room were you know, kids who had just never been designated as refugees. They had just won a green card in a lottery process. Or there were two kids who entered this country without documents, without legal permission, by themselves, without a parent or a guardian.
Wow.
So they were seeking asylum. They were part of the, they were both from El Salvador, and they were part of that, you know, tide of young people coming from Central America, entering this country without legal permission, just fleeing violence in their home countries or looking for parents who had already immigrated to this country. You know, this wave of young people coming here on their own was happening kind of at the same time as the refugee crisis.
Wow.
So it's...
But the refugees in the room, you had asked what led them to leave their home countries. In almost all cases, it was armed conflict or war. So in the Congo, for example, the brothers that I got to know well, their family was from the eastern side of the Congo, and the Congo had a really horrific civil war. And even when that war ended, on the eastern side of the Congo, there were still militia groups very active that would swoop down and raid villages for crops or kill people or abduct young women or commit terrible acts like rape or atrocities. And so it was so unsafe in their part of the Congo that there were many thousands of people leaving and walking to other countries nearby, like Uganda. That's where they went. And they lived in a refugee settlement for 7 years before the United Nations officially, you know, had designated them refugees, and then the U.S. accepted them for resettlement here.
It's just hard to imagine the strain that these children have lived much of their life under. And how can they overcome that?
It is hard to imagine, especially for those of us like me who, you know, spend almost all their time here in the developed world. It's not a life path that we're necessarily familiar with. I think sometimes, you know, when we hear these stories, we imagine that refugees are therefore, you know, to be pitied, or we almost look down on them as like objects of pity, and we think, oh, it might be a burden to accept them. And I have to say, that's the thing that changed the most in my mind after spending time in this classroom, because what I saw when I met these kids was just, you know, the strength that they arrive with because of these life experiences. They've lived through so much. They arrive here and they look around at our life and they're like, huh, life in America is pretty easy. So
I'm sure.
It's hard for them to learn English, of course. But, I mean, they've got hot showers now. They've got heat. They like a bunch of things they're not used to having. And they respond to life here going, oh, wow, I can do this. Like, this is going to be a breeze compared to life in the refugee camp where we were freezing, you know, at night sometimes, and there wasn't enough to eat, and we didn't have a washing machine or a stove. You know, so, like, the amenities of our life are striking to them. But I just noticed that, they really hit the ground running. And I was struck by the difference between, I have a son who's 15 and same age as most of the kids in this classroom. So, you know, the ease of my son's life and therefore, you know, like how untested he is in a certain way compared to the kids in this room, it was very striking for me. I mean, they had been tested in all kinds of ways, by war or by hunger, and they were just so strong as a result. That's how they struck me.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Helen Thorpe, author of The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. Helen, would you share a little bit of the book with us
today? Oh, I would love to.
Great.
Yeah. We were talking about words that travel through languages, and I thought I was going to maybe read from that passage.
Great.
Okay. I think it fits with what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. With the advent of spring, as more and more interactions took place, I found myself able to appreciate in an entirely new fashion how all the different languages represented in the room converged in ways I hadn't recognized before. I glimpsed this convergence one afternoon in the middle of April while sitting with Shani, Jacqueline, and Mariam. And just to explain, Shani is from Tajikistan, and Jacqueline and Mariam are the sisters from Iraq. They were talking about a book that Mr. Williams had started reading out loud with the class. The book was called Cesar Chavez, Fighting for Farm Workers, and it was a nonfiction graphic novel. For Mr. Williams, the story of Cesar Chavez held tremendous power. He got a little emotional trying to explain the significance of this guy his students had never heard of before, trying to put into words why Cesar Chavez mattered. At one point, as I was listening to Shani, Jacqueline, and Mariam discuss the poster they were making to illustrate the book's contents, I found myself wondering how the three girls were managing to communicate. Shani spoke Tajik, Russian, and a little Farsi, while Jacqueline and Mariam were Arabic speakers. They actually spoke several varieties of Arabic and also Turkish, I should add. In other words, the three girls didn't share a common language. Yet they seemed to understand one another perfectly, and they were not using Google Translate, nor English. How were they interacting? I could hear all three of them saying the word kitab. What was that? Look, Shani told me. My language, their language, same. The word for book was virtually identical in each of their home languages. In Arabic, it was kitab. In Tajik, kitab. In Turkish, it was kitap, as Jacqueline pointed out. And in Farsi, Shani hastened to add, the word was kitab, just like Arabic. I don't know if you can hear it as I'm saying it, but all those words have, like, one letter different. There's tiny variations in spelling.
Wow.
Initially, I thought this kind of convergence existed only in the Middle East. But as I spent more time with the students from Africa, I came to realize I was wrong. Dili told me that in Kunama, the word for book was kitaba, and Methuselah said in Swahili it was kitabu. That was the moment when I finally grasped my own arrogance as an English speaker. I mean, the arrogance harbored by someone who knew only European languages, which rendered the well-laced interconnectedness of the rest of the world invisible to me. I was starting to see it, though. The centuries-old ties that bound Africa and the Middle East, born of hundreds of years of trade and travel and conquest and marriage. Mm-hmm. Once the students grasped that, I would exclaim with delight that they found a word that had moved through many of their countries, they started flocking to me to share loanwords and cognates. Mm-hmm. Kalb was the word the students wanted to teach me about the most. One day, over lunch, Shani got very puppy-like about this concept, bouncing around in her chair as we were sitting with Rahim, Jacqueline, and Mariam. Kalb, my language. Kalb, Arabic. Kalb, Farsi. Kalb, Shani proclaimed. Okay, I fought it. Okay, I get it, I thought. They've found another cognate. But what was Kalb? Kalb means heart, Rahim explained. This word, it is the same in all our languages. I tried to get a better sense of the concept, which the students and I discussed over several days. Could you say that their teacher, Mr. Williams, had a kalb that pumped blood through his body? Yes, they confirmed. Could you ask, how much kalb did it take for Mr. Williams to do this year after year with such infinite patience for room after room of newcomers? Yes, the students agreed. When two people fell in love, was that kalb? Yes. I left Sal thinking that kalb and heart were one and the same. I used one word to refer to a muscle in my body and the concept of falling in love, the idea of what it takes to raise a family or teach an entire class full of newcomers from around the world, and the students from the Middle East would use a single word for all that too. Kalb and heart seemed identical. Then I looked up kalb on Google Translate one weekend while the kids were missing me and I was missing the kids. When I asked Google to change heart into Arabic, it gave kalb, as I expected. But when I asked Google to switch kalb into English, I got heart, center, middle, transformation, conscience, core, marrow, pith, pulp, gist, essence, quintessence, topple, alter, tip, overturn, reversal, overthrow, capsize, whimsical, capricious, convert, change, counterfeit. In addition, the word meant substance, being, pluck. I am in love with this word, I thought. What is all this movement about? My own concept of heart did not include flip or capsize or reverse. Our two cultures didn't seem to have the same idea of what was happening at the core of our beings. There was something reified and stolid about my sense of heart, whereas the idea of heart that these kids possessed appeared to have a lighter, more nimble quality. Whatever it was, kalb seemed more fluid and less constrained than anything I had imagined happening inside of me.
And that was Helen Thorpe reading from The Newcomers, Finding Refuge, Friendship, and Hope in an American Classroom. And you are listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline.
You know, it's much more complicated for these refugees than we can even imagine. Because not only to...
Right, it is.
Yeah, not only to get here, to go through what they have to get here, but then to try to figure out, you know, who do they go, who do they trust, who do they go to for help, you know?
Yeah.
And we don't have any idea. That our media doesn't really explain it well, I don't think. This book does.
Not being explained well right now. And of course, you know, some of the concerns being raised are valid, like, yes, we want to vet people, for sure. But we do seem to have forgotten that we're actually really good at that vetting process. And while in Europe, they have had many asylum seekers from the Middle East walking there, nobody is walking from the Middle East here because we've got the Atlantic Ocean between
mm-hmm,
us.
Mm-hmm.
And people from the Middle East who come here have been through an incredibly thorough vetting process that we're really good at, and we're really good at resettling refugees. But you're absolutely right that the journey they're on and what they go through and what that is like is something that we're not really fully empathizing with.
Now, during the time you spent in this classroom, the political climate was changing. How did that impact the kids?
Well, I think the kids felt misunderstood as the rhetoric started getting more and more harsh and more politicized and more polarized. So, I mean, their feeling was, what do you mean you think we want to hurt you? We are so grateful that you just gave us a seat in this classroom. All we want to do is become American as fast as we can. Okay, we don't know exactly what to wear to school in an American high school yet, but we're really trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And We're really trying to figure out English. We know our English is bad, but it's getting fast in a hurry, you know, getting better in a hurry. You know, all they want to do is assimilate, and they're doing as fast as they can. And the idea that refugees are to be feared or anything like that was very hurtful to them, because they thought, oh, no, you don't understand. We have nothing but goodwill. We're so grateful to have a safe home. These kids, I mean, a lot of them had not had a safe home in their memory. So
yeah,
the chance to start over here, they felt only profound gratitude.
Wow. Have you kept in touch with these kids since you finished the book?
Yes, I do mm-hmm. keep in touch with them, especially the families that invited me home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a journalist, you're kind of supposed to, like, keep your distance and not get too close to
yeah,
people, all that
yeah.
stuff. Well, I had many conversations with my longtime editor as I was working on this book. I've done all three books with Scribner, and Colin Harrison is my editor there. And I talked to him on a weekly basis working on this book. And he sort of said, you know, I can tell that you're getting close to these kids and the kids are getting close to you, and that's fine. You should just write about that in this book and write about the fact that you're rooting for them and you're cheering for them and you want them to succeed and you're trying to help them. Mm-hmm. So I did get close to several families, and the Congolese family, I've kind of been like driving one of their sons to and from soccer practice. His mom doesn't have a car, so I told this kid, he's the younger brother of the two brothers in the classroom that I write about in the book. And their younger brother's name is Innocent, which I think is such a funny name. But I drive Innocent to and from soccer, and I told him I was his soccer mom. He had no idea what I was talking about. He's like, what does that mean?
So funny.
I had to explain, in this country, we have moms who, you know, just get to drive their kids to and from soccer practice. And he's like, oh, yeah, that doesn't happen, Congo. We don't have cars.
Yeah. So you spent a year in the classroom, and how did you decide, like, what to focus on in the book, which is organized chronologically throughout that year?
Yeah.
And, you know, how did you decide, like, what things that happened to include, what not to include?
Right. So I wanted to write about a year in the classroom. And then I also wanted to write about the resettlement journey of the parents on the home front with a couple families. So the book is structured so that in the classroom chapters, which are kind of where the book spends most of the time, you're watching the teacher, how he teaches English to these kids, but you're also watching the kids come to life and just emerge as, like, funny, hilarious, boisterous teenagers who want to flirt and, like, propose to each other in math class and, you know, do all the things that teenagers do, even while they're, like, learning and studying hard and being in school. So I think the classroom chapters just get more and more funny as the kids kind of come to life in the room, even as you're kind of watching a teacher teach English, which itself is kind of like maybe a more serious kind of subject than the hilarity of being a teenager. But I wanted to the reader to, like, enjoy the experience of reading this book and yet also witness, like, how does somebody acquire a second language?
Wow.
Then in the chapters on the home front, I was really trying to show the burden that the parents have. So I alternate, like, a classroom chapter with a visit home to one family, and then a classroom chapter and a visit home with the other family. So the two families I focus on, one's Congolese and one's Iraqi. And in both cases, you're watching the parents sacrifice everything so that the kids can be in this classroom. I mean, the parents are taking menial jobs. They are not having the chance to learn English themselves. They're trying as best they can, but basically they've got to work. You know, they're supposed to be economically self-sufficient within 90 days of arriving in the U.S. So
wow.
They've got 3 months to find a job and be off income subsidies, just earning a living. Wow. And, you know, with the Congolese family, you see the dad get a job as a dishwasher, and the older brothers take jobs cleaning as janitors in like a public hotel, in the public areas of a hotel. In the Iraqi family, you see the mom get a job in a factory making dental implants. And these parents are sacrificing themselves so that their kids can learn English, get a high school degree, maybe a college degree, do a better, you know, get a better kind of job than what they're going to be able to do.
Wow. So how much time did you actually spend in the classroom? Did you go once a week? Did you go for longer periods of time?
At the beginning of the year, my rhythm was about 2 days a week. But by January, when the kids started opening up more and there was more happening in the classroom, I began going every day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And did you take
notes? I would stay generally for the three class periods or some part of that.
And were you taking notes? Were you taking notes?
Yes, I was taking notes and often tape recording the lesson that the teacher was giving that day. And then I went back and I read my notes out loud to myself into dictation software, so I would have like an electronic version of all my notes that was searchable. Yeah.
So the dictation software would convert it to text?
Well, I would sit and read into a microphone, it's called Dragon Dictate, and it would change my reading my notebooks out loud into text, so that then it was easier for me then, you know, to have an electronic file.
Isn't technology wonderful?
It's an amazing thing. It was a gift for me to be able to do that.
Oh, gosh.
Did you start writing right away?
No, I spent the 2015-2016 school year in the classroom, and I began writing that summer.
Okay.
I did take a trip to the Congo at the beginning of the summer to understand better what the Congolese family had fled from. But as soon as I got back to the U.S., I wrote up my trip to the Congo first, and then I went back to the beginning of the school year and wrote chronologically from the beginning of the school year through the end of the school year.
Wow.
And then it was time to see what happened in year two. So I did go back to South High School again as the kids returned for their second year of school in the U.S. And I didn't go, like, every day, but I just visited intermittently. So the newcomers were all together during their first year, but then they were placed into, like, different classes during their second year, depending on how much English they'd acquired. So I was visiting, like, a couple different classrooms during their second year just to see where were the kids in their second year, like, who had progressed the most, what were they reading, or, you know, the kids who hadn't gone as far, what were they reading?
You know, it's interesting that they, you and I'm assuming the school refers to it as English acquisition and how much English they acquired.
There's a different term for this around the country. Some places call it English as a second language. Some places call it English language learners, and some call it English language acquisition. Honestly, I don't really know why the different terms have evolved in different regions, but at South, it's English language acquisition.
Interesting.
Yeah, it
is. I guess maybe English as a second language is often a misnomer because a lot of these kids have already two or three or four languages before they learn English.
Exactly.
And English is not an easy language to learn, correct?
It's not. It is not. We have very funny spellings, for one thing. You know, like we've got a lot of letters that are silent. Like we have GH sometimes in the middle of a word and you don't say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you have what are those words called that sound the same but are spelled completely differently?
Through, though, whatever.
Yeah.
Homophone. That must be hard. Oh, boy. It's hard for some of us even, you know.
I know it.
So how did you decide which characters, which students to focus on?
Right. Well, At the outset, it was not clear to me who I would be focusing on, but pretty soon, after some key people arrived in the room, I was like, oh, that's really interesting. So, for example, the two sisters from Iraq showed up. I think, you know, they had missed, like, the first 6 weeks of school. So for the first 6 weeks, I was, like, wondering, who should I be focusing on? But they weren't even in the room yet. Mm. As soon as they showed up, I was like, oh, my gosh, here's two kids from the Middle East. And I know that's, you know, our news cycle's dominated by this idea of refugees from the Middle East. So I'm very interested in them. Also, it was just puzzling to me because one sister was wearing a headscarf covering her hair and mm-hmm. one was not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, why is only one of them wearing a headscarf?
And what was the answer to that?
Well, when I started visiting them at home with an Arabic language interpreter, I learned all kinds of things that I didn't understand. So it turned out their mom was Muslim, but their dad was Christian. And so the girls, their mom had told them they were free to choose whichever faith that she thought both faiths were legitimate and you know, it was up to them if they wanted to attend a church or a synagogue. And so, you know, Mariam, I think, identified more with, she's named for Mary, the mother of Jesus. And Jacqueline, I think, identified a little bit more as a Muslim. Mm.
Interesting.
Their family, you know, was fascinating to me because it turned out their dad had cooperated with the U.S. military when we invaded Iraq, and, you know, the family was targeted because of that, and that's why they had to flee from Iraq. But then they went to what they thought would be a safe country, and that was Syria.
Oh, my.
Only to get caught up in the Syrian civil war.
Yeah.
To flee that country. So they were double refugees.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, those girls had seen all kinds of things. Terrible car bombings in Damascus, Syria. So I was very moved by the drama of their story and their dad trying to help the U.S. and then that causing them to be sent off on this incredible odyssey for so long looking for a safe place to live and not finding it and trying again. And right around the same time that they showed up in the classroom, the two boys from the Congo showed up, Solomon and Methuselah. They were interesting to me right away because they started very quickly just becoming so proficient in English. Their learning curve was steeper. They were learning more English faster than anybody in the room. And I was really awed by them, and so was the teacher. So the teacher was making comments to me like, gosh, you know, can you believe how fast Solomon and Methuselah are learning? So I began visiting those two families at home as soon as the kids were settled and, you know, as soon as I brought in interpreters and met with them. About halfway through the year, I began visiting their parents at home to get to know them better.
And then the third student that you focused on, Christina, has even a different journey.
Yeah. So once I figured I wanted to write about a family from the Congo and a family from Iraq, it occurred to me, well, Helen, you've got representation then from Africa, and you've got representation from the Middle East, but what about Southeast Asia? Because that's the third region that's producing lots of refugees. And I knew there were kids whose families were from Burma in the room, so I was trying to find a student in the classroom to represent Burma and what's happening there and that part of the refugee crisis. But there were two boys in the room whose families were originally from Burma, and in both cases, their families had fled, gone to Thailand, and gotten stuck inside refugee camps there for so long that their children were born inside the refugee camps. So the boys from Burma in the classroom had only ever lived inside a refugee camp their whole entire lives.
Wow.
So I think the transition was so overwhelming for them. I mean, it was their first time in the developed world. They were learning English, but they'd never lived outside a camp before. So the whole idea of freedom and, just mass transit was new to them because their life inside the refugee camp had been so circumscribed.
Wow.
So they were overwhelmed, is my sense, and neither of those boys really wanted to talk to me a whole lot. And so I didn't feel comfortable pushing them. Like if they didn't really want to talk to me, I just wanted to let them be in the classroom. We were kind of talking about this earlier, trying to honor where the kids were in their journeys and protect them from own curiosity and not burden them with my trying to tell their story.
Right.
If it's not what was good for them. So in the process of like trying and failing to get to know those two boys at a deeper level, what happened was I became close to one of the interpreters that I used, and her name's Christina, as you mentioned, and she herself had been a student at the same high school. When I met her, she was actually a college student, and she was working as my interpreter with the boys, but then she wanted to tell me her story, and I thought, well, okay, instead of telling the story of one of the students in the room, I'll tell the interpreter's story instead.
Wow.
And her story was, kind of shocking and illuminating to me. Like, her story was that back when she had been in eighth grade, her first year in the U.S., her grandmother... She had come here without either of her parents, just in the care of her grandmother, along with her sisters. Her grandmother had tried to marry Christina off at age 13 to a much older man in his 20s. The grandmother thought that this was okay, and Christina really didn't want to do it.
Oh, wow.
And, the whole idea of becoming a child bride was horrifying to her, and she was fighting with her grandmother about that.
Wow.
And then her grandmother ended up being physically abusive and cutting her with a knife in the process.
Wow.
And then a teacher in her eighth grade classroom, an American teacher at her middle school, noticed the wound and asked Christina why her hand was bandaged at school, why she couldn't write. And Christina, didn't want to say, didn't know if she could trust the teacher. Her English wasn't very good yet. And the teacher really pushed her, and Christina finally confessed that her grandmother had hurt her. And then the teacher ended up,
reporting that. And
her sisters reporting it, which meant they were taken out of their home. That was very disorienting for Christina, especially not with having, enough English to understand what was happening.
Wow. Well, Helen, we're going to have to cut you off on that. We're about out of time. But, so for listeners, check out The Newcomers, Finding Refuge.
I would just add that an American family adopted Christina, and she says it was the best thing that ever happened to her.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, all right.
I was going to say, you're going to have to read the book to find out what happens.
Yeah.
Spoiler
alert.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. This is a really
my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's a very important book.
It is. It is, because we need to know these things. We really do.
Yeah. Mom, do you have some final words for
us? Yeah, I do. This just fits these kids. The scars of life remind us where we have been. They don't have to dictate where we're going.
Thank you. Yeah. And thank you, Helen. And see you next week.
Pleasure.
On Writers' Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by